The morning was basically I think I got to the line where the claim was. So we have a symmetry in a field theory that implies we have a current. So each symmetry, if we have a continuous symmetry in a field theory, we have a current that goes with it. And then if we spontaneously break that symmetry, there's this Goldstone state. So if Q is the integral of J0 D3X satisfies Q and the ground state is not zero, then there's a state G for which that matrix element is not zero. That was the claim. So the reason why the claim is true is so the two things I have to talk about now are why is this true and why do you care? So the why it's true part is the, you know, our starting point was we had this field phi, which had a non-zero expectation value, and it was the variation of something. So it was it was delta psi. And so that was I times the variation, so Q psi minus psi Q. And then Q I can write as this integral again. So it's J0 psi minus psi J0. And so you can kind of see where this argument is going to come from. The existence of this state is going to come because what I'll do is I'll insert a partition of unity here. You know, assert one is the sum over all states in between these operators. And what we know is that since this was not zero, it has to be true that somebody in the sum picks up a non-zero matrix element between the current and the ground state. And it's also true that that same state is going to have a non-zero matrix element with the field whose transformation was giving us the order parameter. So that's a second matrix element we know also has to be non-zero. And that's the one we're talking about. So if it were true that there was no state like this, then it would be true that when I insert a complete set here, every term in the sum would be zero, and then it would be true that this was zero, which it's not by assumption. So that's kind of why it had to exist. But more interesting is what its properties are. And so all the properties of Goldstone bosons are coming from the fact that this matrix element is not zero. And since we know a lot about the vacuum, like its Lorentz invariant and its translation invariant, and we know, if you tell me the symmetry, I know exactly what this current is. So I know that this is a four vector, and I know maybe it's parity even if it's a symmetry which commutes with parity, or maybe it's not. But whatever, you tell me what the symmetry is, and I tell you what the current is. And then those things, if I take all the symmetries in my problem, I can organize. There's only the quantum numbers of states for which this can be non-zero are limited. And so, for example, since the vacuum has no spin, and since the zeroth component of the vacuum of the current also has no spin, because that's no rotational spin, that means that this thing has to be spinless. If the current had been a spinner vector, which it would have been under supersymmetry, then the same argument would have said, this has got no spin, this is spin a half, so this has to be spin a half. If this is a parity even thing and the vacuum is parity even, then this has to be also parity even. If the vacuum is parity even and this is parity odd, then this state has to be parity odd. So you can learn a lot of the properties of the Goldstone of this particle just from the fact that it's connected to the vacuum by this non-zero matrix element. But the most important one is that it's guaranteed to be in the low energy theory because it has no gap. And so the way you show that is to do what here? What's the simplest thing to do?
How do you know that the current is spin zero?
Because I know that the vacuum is spin zero. And I know that the zeroth component of the one that was appearing here was the zeroth component of J.
Yeah.
That's a scalar. That's a rotational scalar.
Okay.
So everybody here is a rotational scalar. And so what I do is I put in a rotation. I insert the way you formally prove it is you put in a rotation adjoint here, and then R dagger J R is the rotation of J. So that'll just be J again because it didn't do anything. Then R dagger on this is omega because it's invariant. And so then you learn that it has to be true that this is equal to the same thing where I have R on G. So R on G is equal to G. Because what we're doing is we're combining spins. This is like if this had a spin J and this say had spin J prime, then I'm trying to get a rotational invariant out of it. So there's rules as to what combinations of spin J and spin J prime can give me a singlet.
Yeah.
But if everybody's a singlet except for this, then this has to be a singlet.
Right. So I guess what changes the supersymmetry with that when J is zero?
The difference is that J is not a vector in that case. So in that case, what happens, remember, what really happened was I had a transformation parameter here, which I've been ignoring. So if I've written the parameter here, omega A, QA, implicitly what we're using is that this was a scalar. This was just some number. But for supersymmetry, this would have been a spinner. And then the way I get a transformation that would make sense is that the spinner is combining with a spinner vector here. And so then this would have a spin a half as well as the vector thing.
So Goldstone theorem says that there exists a G, is that G unique?
No, there's generally a lot of states that do this. But the important thing is that the existence is that there can't be a gap between the vacuum. There's not a gap between the ground state and the next thing. That this state G has to have an energy which goes to zero as the momentum goes to zero, which I'll show you now. And that's just coming from the conservation of
why do you have a
mu
there? And proof you only use the zero component.
Yeah, but if I do a Lorentz transformation of the zeroth component, then the whole four vector has to be there. But it's true that all I really need for anything, any of the properties I'm gonna drive are all gonna come from the fact that it was a zero. So the fast way, if you have a Lorentz invariant theory, then the proof that this thing is massless, which is the same thing as it being gapless in that case, is simple because since it's spinless, the x dependence of this thing is, so let me make the argument. So the claim is that this Goldstone state has some energy, which will depend on its momentum. Has the property, so where E of P has the property that the limit as P goes to zero of E of P equals zero. So that's the statement, there's no gap. There's no, as momentum goes to zero, the energy goes away completely. And that kind of morally is corresponding to this is almost like saying that this state is obtained by doing a symmetry transformation of the vacuum, and we know that that should have cost us no energy. But we didn't quite do that because we didn't want to use the charge, we wanted to use the current, so we made a very slightly varying symmetry transformation of the vacuum, and so that wasn't exactly a symmetry, but it becomes better and better approximation of symmetry the more slowly varying the parameter is. And that's what's going on here, is that because we have a position dependence, we don't have exactly a massless state, but if we make the momentum go to zero, which corresponds to making the variation very, very, very long wavelength, the energy gets arbitrarily low, because in the limit that the momentum went to zero, it was a symmetry transformation, and so it cost no energy. Okay, so the way you show this formally is that we know that G of P, J zero of X, omega, that's not zero. And so we can write the x dependence out explicitly by slapping a translation on either side. So it's either I p mu x mu. Let me say p alpha x alpha. So I know I can always extract the space-time dependence by doing a translation and a time evolution. And but then I know that this is just equal to omega because the vacuum has no energy and no momentum. It's translation invariant. And this is going to be, I know what it's given by because this is a state which is by assumption diagonalizing P, the momentum. It's got an energy and it's got a momentum. So P acting on G is the momentum P acting on G. This might be clearer if I use a different letter, maybe. Let me do that. So then I know that this factor is just going to be G of Q times the number e to the I Q dot X. So when the dust is settled, this is equal to e to the I Q dot X G of Q J mu 0 omega. So now what I do is I differentiate this thing. So let's calculate I'll take the d mu of this. So I have d mu of GQ J mu X omega. On the one hand, if I differentiate this thing, the X dependence is here. So that's going to be equal to the matrix element of this. But that's zero because that's the statement of current conservation. That's conservation. But on the other hand, I can just explicitly differentiate it because this is the x dependence. So that's going to be I q mu e to the I q dot x. So now what do we do? Let's focus on, so let's take the momentum equals zero. So let's take the limit as spatial q goes to zero of this expression. And what happens is that the space part of this, where q space dots onto j space, it's going to go to zero because I've taken q to zero. So all I'm going to be left with is the time part of this, where I'll have the energy as a function of q in the limit that q goes to zero times the matrix element. So that'll be it'll be minus I times the energy. It'll be the limit. Q goes to zero of minus I times the energy as a function of Q, e to the minus I energy as a function of Q times time. And because of this set of equalities, I know that's equal to zero. But I know that that's not zero, because that was the Goldstone theorem. And that's not zero because that's a phase. So this is the thing that has to be vanishing. So that implies that the limit as q goes to zero of e of q is zero. So that's the gaplessness argument. And so the relevance to us is that that means if you spontaneously break a global symmetry, global because this parameter omega was constant, it'll always be true at low energies that there's a light state, because this state is there no matter how low the energy gets. You're not guaranteed that this is a single particle state. So it's not necessarily true that this state will just be a single particle state. It might be a two-particle state, so it's labeled by more than just momentum. And that's something which will depend on the details of the system. But it's in perturbative situations like we're going to be dealing with, like in the toy model we started off with, and in cases where the interactions are weak, it typically is true that this is a single particle state. And so it becomes a single particle state whose mass is zero. If it's a multi-particle state, it's a multi-particle state, all of whose masses are zero, or the combined state has to have an energy which is zero in the zero momentum limit.
It's just the spatial component of the momentum there. Can you always choose a frame to make this zero?
No, because for example, if I did that for the electron, its mass is the thing that if the momentum goes to zero. If it had been a Lorentz invariant system, E would have been the square root of Q squared plus M squared. And so the statement I'm making there is that M is zero. But this is also true in a non-relativistic, although I'm using kind of Lorentz covariant notation here. Nothing here really is relying on Lorentz invariance. All I'm relying on is rotational invariance and the symmetry. So in a condensed matter system, all these statements are still true. But you wouldn't know that the energy was so simple as this, but it would still be true that there's a gapless state Okay. So what's this got to do with effective field theory? So the idea is that this state has to be there, and it's also true that if we looked at correlation functions of J, so supposing we took the ground state, J, 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 ground state, time-ordered product. Because of this matrix element being non-zero, there's a general argument that says that if you gave me the correlation function of J as many, to an arbitrary number of times, I could calculate for you the scattering amplitudes for these Gs with themselves. What you do, if someone gives you a Green's function for a field which has the property that the matrix element of that field between a particle and the ground state is non-zero, then you can always extract the scattering matrix for the particle by looking at correlation functions of the corresponding operator. And I'm not deriving that, but that's the has a name. The LSZ reduction. And what you essentially do is in these correlation functions, you look for the poles in momentum space when these particles have momenta and energy which are satisfying their spectral relation, their dispersion relation. And when you do that, the residue is if you're looking for n particle scattering, you look for a combination of momenta for which you have an nth order pole where the correlation function is diverging like n powers of 1 over E squared minus Q squared plus M squared, and the residue of that is always up to some factor, the scattering amplitude for these particles. That's a theorem. And so the fact that these currents are conserved, in this case, that theorem would be applied to correlation functions of the conserved current, and because the current is conserved, it has a property like this, that its divergence is zero. And what that does is that means that the scattering of Golson bosons at low energy will also be constrained to be small, because you can make an argument like this, but now don't do it for correlation functions of many J's. And so the symmetries are restricting the interactions of these Golson bosons at low energies, and the interactions themselves are becoming small at low energies, because the thing that's involved in calculating their behavior is the current. But so those are all true statements, but they're kind of hard to get at in this kind of a formalism. But this is historically the way that they were first found. And so effective field theories are much, much, much the most efficient way of getting that information out. And so what we want to do is, the goal should be, we want to write down an effective theory at low energies where these Goldstone bosons are particles in our problem. And we want to build into that Lagrangian the symmetries of the problem. So if we have a bunch of symmetries, some of them are broken, some of them are not broken, we want to know how are those symmetries represented on the Goldstone boson fields. And I'd like to do the analog of, in our toy model, we had a complex field, which we wrote as being rho e to the I theta. And then the symmetry phi goes to e to the I alpha phi. In terms of rho and theta, it became, you know, rho goes to rho, and theta goes to theta plus alpha. And so this was, theta turned out to be the field that described the Goldstone boson in that example. And we found that its scattering was actually, became very, very weak in the low energy limit. And we saw an easy way to understand that in an effective field theory language was once we recognized that we could write it as a field with this kind of a symmetry acting on it, then this symmetry in itself forbade theta from ever appearing in a scalar potential. And that was how you could see that all any interactions involved derivatives in the end of the day. I'd like to make an argument like that, but not one that's restricted to an abelian group like this. I want to take the general case where you have some group G and there's a bunch of expectation values that break it to some subgroup H. And there's a general expression for, there's a general analog of this transformation rule for that general symmetry breaking pattern, which can be identified once and for all. And then we can go through the exercise of building the Lagrangian that's consistent with that symmetry. And then that will automatically have built into it all the consequences of these current arguments, the weakness of the interactions at low energies and what the symmetries are, how much the symmetries are constraining the kinds of interactions you can get. So that's the goal, is we want to do an analog of this, but in a more general context of some symmetry group G breaking to some subgroup H. So the statement was that scattering of these G states can be obtained from correlation functions of the current. And this is, I'm alluding to the LSZ reduction formulae. So if you want to go look those up, that's a standard field theory topic that relates S matrix elements to correlation functions.
In some cases, it's possible that omega is not, the vacuum state is not transportation invariant.
That can happen, yeah.
So, that this proof is not, has some problem, then may have some.
Well, then the problem will be that you don't in general have momentum as a label, because you don't have translations of the symmetry. Well, it depends, actually, I guess there's two situations. So it could be that the system is translation invariant, but the vacuum's not, like it's spontaneously broken. But then it would be true that we're not expecting the particles to be labeled by the momentum. So then the claim would still be true that there's a low energy state, because the physics of why it's a low energy state is just that you know that if you take what's really physically going on here is that the field that's describing, if you think about this example, these are really all supposed to be functions of x, right? But in the limit that this was independent of x, it just became the symmetry, and so you knew that it was dropping out of the Lagrangian in the limit that it was x independent. So that argument is always going to work. That's not a statement about the vacuum; that's a statement about the action. So as long as you have a symmetry of the action, it will be true that if you can find a field for which the symmetry transformation is essentially just shifting by the symmetry parameter, then it will be true that that field is going to want to drop out of the Lagrangian if you restrict it to be a constant, because that's just a statement that Lagrangian was invariant. And so that's the statement that the interactions are weak. And it's not relying on the properties of the vacuum in that sense. It's the way I phrased it here, I've assumed that momentum is a good label, yeah.
So you mean that this masslessness doesn't relate to the translation invariance of the vacuum, only
this was really what the relevance of momentum here was, that the energy is a function of the variable of the other labels that the state has, and this is claiming that you always can dial those labels so that you have the energy is arbitrarily small. And in this case, momentum is the one that you're normally dialing.
Okay.
So an example where this could still be true, you know, like a condensed matter system where you actually have a lattice, that's an example where you have a translation invariant dynamic or Hamiltonian. The ground state was not translation invariant, but it was periodically translation invariant. And so you still have momentum as a label, but it's got this, it's only momentum on some unit cell rather than all possible momenta. And so then this verbatim would go through, and that there'd be a label momentum you could use, and there'd be some choice. It might not be zero, but there's some choice of Q for which the energy is going to zero. And so the it needn't fail just because the ground state is not translation invariant. It won't fail. It's because the physics of it is that if this thing, if the Goldstone field is independent of position, it is the symmetry. And so the statement that the its interactions are going away when it's a constant is a statement that the symmetry was there. It is the symmetry, and the fact that the symmetry was a property of the Lagrangian. If I did this transformation, alpha was not in the Lagrangian because that was the statement it was a symmetry. So if I take this and I put it in the Lagrangian and I restrict myself to theta equals constant, then it's the symmetry, and so it's no longer in the Lagrangian. So that says that theta will only appear in the Lagrangian differentiated. It might appear undifferentiated, but it always will be with derivative. So I might get things like theta d theta or something, but I'll never get it. Yeah, I'll never get anything without any derivative. So the mass is not, but it's not just mass. This is just saying mass. It's also a statement about all the interactions because it's not in the potential at all. It's not just that the curvature is zero at the minimum. And so this statement about the S matrix is a statement about interactions. You know, I could scatter them as many times as I like. And the thing, the very first day of the class, when I was showing you that the scattering matrix for this light field is always going to zero at zero momentum, that was stronger than saying it was massless. And not only is it massless, but all its interactions are going away in the zero momentum limit. And that's saying it's not in the scalar potential at all. And the symmetry is just driving that. Okay, let me finish sentence here. So current conservation brings this scattering as well. At low energies. And in particular makes G weakly interacting at low energies. And it doesn't matter if the thing that, so an example of this will turn out to be, you know, pions in QCD are, to a good approximation, Goldstone bosons, and they're being built out of quarks and gluons that are strongly interacting. So the basic interactions involved in them are strongly interacting, but it's still true that the Goldstone boson is weakly interacting at low energies because of a general argument. And it doesn't matter if the thing it's being built out of is weakly interacting. Okay. So what we want to do is we want to show this to use this symmetry information info most efficiently. And effective field theories are the way to do that. Are the way to go. So what I need to do is I need to say, so let's suppose we have a system where with a global symmetry group G, a continuous symmetry group. So we'll have a current, and let's say there's a, you know, n with n parameters. So that means we'll have n currents. And let's also suppose that some subgroup, some of these symmetries are broken spontaneously. So suppose a series of fields have expectation values so that the ground state is only invariant under a subgroup. Let's say it's an n parameter subgroup, little n. And let's call it H, contained in G. What we want to know is, what's the statement about how these things interact at low energy? So what we want is the effective field theory describing the interactions of the Goldstone bosons. How many Goldstone bosons should we expect there to be? Well, we know that there are capital N symmetries, and we're expecting that we've got little n of these symmetries that are not broken. So for every parameter that's broken, we should expect to find a Goldstone boson. So we should expect n minus little n Goldstone bosons. There are exceptions to this argument. You see, when we do the non-relativistic case, there will be cases where the counting of the Goldstone boson is a little bit different. And it's also true for space-time symmetries, it's a little bit different. So for example, when you know a crystal lattice is an example where you had a Hamiltonian that was translation invariant, and but the ground state was not. And in that case, there are actually Goldstone bosons for that breaking, corresponding to the phonons in the lattice. That the phonons have a dispersion relation where their energy goes like k squared, where k is the momentum, and in particular, it goes down to zero momentum, goes down to zero energy. Because they're the Goldstone bosons for translation invariant breaking. But you also had rotations in a crystal lattice, and you might have asked, well, are there three other Goldstone bosons to do with the breaking of that? And there can be, but there needn't be. So there's an issue for counting the Goldstone bosons, and essentially what it comes down to is, what counts is the currents. Every independent current you have for which you get to make this statement that there's a non-zero matrix element, you're going to have a Goldstone boson. And if you think about space-time symmetries, the current is the stress energy, T mu nu, and the charges, like the rotation generators and the translation generators, are all being built out of T mu nu. You know, the T0i is the thing that you integrate to get the momentum generators. But to get the rotation generators, you're taking T mu nu and you're contracting it, you're multiplying it by powers of x and doing integrals, but you don't have a new current for that. It's the same currents again. And so part of the counting I'm giving you here applies to space-time symmetries, but the important thing to count is not the number of parameters in the group, it's count the number of currents you have. So in that case, the stress energy was giving you the Goldstone modes, and then you're not getting Goldstone modes twice because you had two different pieces of a group which are all corresponding to the same current. Another counting issue comes in. And if you read the example about the ferromagnets in the Goldstone boson notes, when we do non-relativistic systems, you'll see that we'll have a first-order field equation, and the counting of the degrees of freedom changes a little bit compared to what we've been doing here. But with those, modulo those two things, this is how many Goldstone bosons we'd expect to find. And so. So what I need to do is I need to give you a transformation rule for the Goldstone bosons. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to do what I did in the abelian case. I'm going to take an example of a non-abelian version of what we did here to suggest the transformation rule. And the claim will be that the transformation rule we're going to arrive at is a general one, in the sense that if somebody hands you a theory like this, you can always do a field redefinition that makes the transformation rule take the standard form. So there's no loss of generality in using this transformation rule I'm going to give you. So what we need is how the symmetries act on the Goldstone boson fields. So we're looking for a generalization of this rule. So to set that up, let's do the analog of the toy model, but now let's imagine we have more fields, so we have a non-abelian group. So let's consider an example. So let's imagine we have some sort of a column vector's worth of fields, phi 1, phi, it's not the same n, let's say phi, s. And let's say that the Lagrangian for this theory is minus a half. Let's say this is a real field. If you have a theory where it's not real, then I take the real part of your field and I take the imaginary part of your field and I write them as new fields. So that there's no loss of generality in taking them to be real. So let's take the kinetic term to be partial mu phi transpose partial mu phi, and have some potential which is a function of phi transpose phi. So by construction, I'm building in a symmetry where I can do arbitrary orthogonal rotations on this column vector. So symmetry will be phi goes to an orthogonal matrix. Let's call it G. Let's call it little g times phi, where G is an S by S orthogonal matrix. So this would be the special case where we have a complex field. I could have written it as phi 1, phi 2 as a column vector, and then it would have been had this language. Then the symmetry we're talking about here would have been an O2 transformation, where I have a 2 by 2 orthogonal transformation, which is a rotation matrix, you know, cosine theta, sine theta. And so I could have written, if I'd written this in terms of real fields as I originally did, that would be the special case here. We have S equals 2. But we could imagine doing this for S equals anything you like. And so I'm imagining our group that we're talking about is sitting inside this orthogonal group, or I guess what I call G over there would be this, G would be then the class, the set of all these G's. So that would be OS. Which is the S by S orthogonal matrices. And let's say that with that the potential is minimized by some non-zero thing. And in this particular example, what's going to happen if I minimize the potential the way I've designed it, you know, it'll phi transpose phi will point in some direction because the potential will tell me the value of phi transpose phi. And typically that'll make one of these, I could choose one of these guys to be non-zero and all the other ones to be zero. And so the remaining symmetry that's unbroken would be the SOS minus one transformations that rotate the non-zero degrees of directions. So this particular model will take me to a specific choice for H, but I'm not going to actually restrict what I'm going to say to that choice. I'm just going to imagine there's maybe I have more fields. Maybe my symmetry group G might not have been the whole ON. Maybe it's got a smaller symmetry, and so I have a more complicated potential than just something which depends on the sum of the squares, and I can design the potential to have some sort of a more complicated symmetry breaking pattern. It's not going to matter that I'm choosing an example where this is going to be such a simple choice. What I want to do is I want to set up the analog of this change of variables here, where I go from the original field phi to a set of variables which are not transforming, or transforming in a simpler way, or transforming only under the unbroken group, and a set of variables which are describing the Goldstone modes. So what we'll do is let's define the change of variables. We'll do the analog of this. We'll go to polar coordinates. And the spirit of this transformation was I took a field and then I did a symmetry transformation on it, but then I regarded the symmetry transformation parameter to be the field, a new field, and those are the Goldstone bosons. And then that meant I've got more fields than I... If this was originally a complex field, and so if this was complex, then I have too many fields, because now I've gone from two fields to three if I have a complex field here and another real field here. So I have to have a restriction on this one. So what I did in the previous case is I made it real, and then that restriction together with these two fields were a reparameterization of the original two fields, and I'm looking for the same thing here. I want to phrase this as a field that's restricted in some way. In this case, it was real, and then I'm going to do a symmetry transformation on that and call the parameters the Goldstone boson fields. So let's do that. So let's write this as being a symmetry transformation G of theta. So let's say that let me first write this. So let's write it as G times chi. So now where the symmetry, I could have written it as e to the I some parameter times the generator. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take, so if I call that G of omega, what I want to do is I want to take these omegas and I want to replace them by fields. So I'm going to write this as G of theta. So where if this was a group element, then G of theta is going to be defined to be e to the I theta of x times t. So this was a constant. So this is no longer a symmetry transformation because it depends on x, because I'm using, I'm going to think of this parameter as being a field. So that's what this is. And this is going to be the analog of rho. It can't be an arbitrary column vector anymore because then I've got too many variables. I have to have a set of constraints that will restrict what this can be along the lines of the constraint that rho was real. So what I want to do is I want to require that this field chi, whatever it is, it should be orthogonal to the Goldstone boson directions, which are the ones that I'm trying to now describe with these thetas. So what we'll do is we'll demand chi be perpendicular to the Goldstone boson directions. Because I'm just trying to relabel I have S fields here, and I've identified now some subset of those fields. And I can't allow this to be an arbitrary S component column vector because now I've got more than S fields. So if I'm going to just rewrite these original S fields in this way, I have to impose a bunch of constraints on this, as many constraints as I have variables here, so I don't have to introduce any new variables.
Right. Why perpendicular?
Well, because I want these guys to be the Goldstone boson directions.
Oh, right. Okay.
And so I want these guys to not be them. So in the Mexican hat kind of picture, if you like, the polar coordinate argument was the Goldstone boson direction. I took something like the vacuum, and then the symmetry direction was the Goldstone boson direction. Then the other direction was the non-Goldstone boson direction, but I required it to be perpendicular to the direction of the symmetry. So what is the Goldstone boson direction? Well, I have to imagine the Goldstone boson direction should be I find the vacuum and I do a symmetry transformation on it to see where the symmetry goes. So let's suppose that the V is this column vector, V1 to Vs, is the vacuum value of phi. Then the symmetry direction will be, delta V, which would be I'm imagining a small transformation. If the transformations have this form, a small one would be, if I take omega to be small, this would be 1 plus I omega t. So the small transformation would be I omega t acting on my field. I'll have I omega acting on V. So this should be the Goldstone boson direction, because this is the analog of moving around the Mexican hat in that previous example. And so what I want to do is I want to ask for chi to be perpendicular to this. So what I'll do is I'll ask for, my condition will be, will demand that V transpose T A chi is 0. So i.e. chi is perpendicular to the Goldstone boson direction. That'll be their criterion. And in the notes, there's a proof that this can actually be done for compact roots, but let's just take it at face value now. All right. The compact comes in because we're typically interested in for transformations of fields, we want finite dimensional representations, and I'm setting them up in such a way that they're unitary. And then the groups which have finite dimensional unitary representations are the compact groups. And then the compactness comes in because you can define something whose derivative with respect to the group parameter is the stationary point, if it exists, would be this condition. And because the parameter of the group is compact, there's a theorem that says that any function of a compact variable has to have maximum and minimum. Can't remember whose theorem that is. It's Gauss's law, but that's a. I can tell you what the theorem is if you push me on it. But it's so there's an argument that says that you can get to this. The issue is, if I hand you some random field, can you do a field or a symmetry transformation that puts you that aligns chi in such a way that it satisfies this? And the claim is that for any compact group, you can. And it's not a it's like a three-line argument, so it's not a complicated argument, but it's in those notes.
It's also saying that the derivative of chi in the direction of the symmetry generator is zero.
Not so much derivative, but the symmetry transformation of the of if I did a symmetry transformation of chi, it's perpendicular to V, is another way of saying it. You can read it either way, that the symmetry acted on V and chi was perpendicular to that, or I did a symmetry transformation of chi and it was perpendicular to V. There's a thing I wanted to say here, which I'm going to forget. Oh yeah. So at this point, it's worth actually keeping track of which generators are appearing here, because if there are some unbroken directions, so if the group is not completely broken by the expectation values, then there will be some generators for which this is zero just because the generators vanish when you hit the vacuum. So for example, in this example here, if the vacuum had been the choice where this is non-zero and everybody else is zero, then any generator which is just living in the bottom sector here is going to automatically for free annihilate V just because it hits zeros. So those generators, there's no information in for those ones. The only ones that will give you information here are the generators for which that do not annihilate V, and those are the broken ones. So you're only getting a condition here for every broken generator. So there's a condition here for every Goldstone boson in the problem. So let me distinguish those two things. Let's break up the T's. So suppose the expectation values break G down to H. So that is to say, H is a set of transformations which leave G invariant. So H on V is equal to V if H is an element of H. And G on V is not equal to V if G is not in H. So in terms of the infinitesimal generators, if I write G as being, I've been writing G as being e to the, let's say G is e to the I omega A T A. Let me rewrite these. I want to take the set of generators T sub A. I'd like to write them as the generators of H, which I'll call little t sub I, and the rest. So if there were S of these, and if there were n of these, and there are little n of these, then there'll be n minus n of these. And I'm going to use the label alpha to label these guys, and little I to label these guys, and A, B, and C to label these guys. So these guys were defined by T acting on V is equal to zero. And the other ones are defined by they're not zero. So because of that, it's only really the X's that count here. So we've got V transpose X alpha chi is equal to zero is our, that's our condition. So that's a way of breaking the fields up, and it has the advantage that, you know, the motivation for it is that these fields theta are by construction going to be, if I restrict them to constant values, then I've now done a symmetry transformation on chi. So if I make the substitution, this substitution in the Lagrangian, theta will drop out of the problem if theta is a constant. That was what it was designed to do. And so that, in that sense, it's the non-abelian generalization of this statement here. That was why those definitions were done the way they were. And what we want to do now is ask, if we've done this definition, then what's the action of the group G on these fields that are left over? So I've now taken phi and I've divided it up into the Goldstone bosons, the thetas, and possibly some other fields. So these would be like the chi's would be the analogs of these rows, which were the heavy fields in the original toy model. And so these are fields that may or may not be in the low energy theory, but if they are, I should be able to tell you how the symmetry acts on them. And the thetas are the Goldstone bosons, and I should be able to tell you how the symmetry acts on them. But whatever that rule is, it's not the same rule as what happened to the phis, because the phis had the simple rule where phi get multiplied by this matrix G. So the goal is to, with these definitions, to infer the transformation rule for theta and chi under the symmetry group. So how does G act on the thetas? I have one for each of the x's and chi. So what we'll just do is we'll take the definition. So phi was defined to be g of theta chi. And we know that phi goes to g times phi. So that means that under the let me write this as being more formally. The transform variable phi twiddle is just given by taking g times phi. So that means that phi twiddle, which I would define, if you handed me phi twiddle, I would have defined in terms of it theta and chi in the same way as I did over there. So g of theta twiddle and chi twiddle. I'm looking for a rule. Theta goes to theta twiddle, chi goes to chi twiddle, which when taken together is the same thing as phi goes to phi twiddle, where that's this rule. So I take the starting point, phi, and the ending point, phi twiddle, and I define g and theta and chi for both of them the way I did over there. And I know that they're related to each other in this way. So I know that, let me not use the g here. Let me save g for the symmetry transformation. I'll call this u, and I think that's also what I called it in my notes. But u is again, it's, you know, u is e to the I theta alpha x alpha. And g is e to the I omega a t a. So it's an arbitrary transformation. And I can always write this transformation if I want in terms of the two kinds of generators. I can write it if I like to be e to the I omega alpha x alpha times e to the I, let's call it, omega I ti. All right, so I'll put them all together. And what we know is that u of theta twiddle chi twiddle is g of u of theta chi. And so that tells me, so a completely stupid thing I can do is I can just multiply by the inverse of u. So in particular, this says that chi twiddle, if I can figure out how the thetas transform, then the chi twiddles will transform according to chi twiddle is equal to gamma chi, where gamma is defined to be u inverse of theta twiddle g times u of theta. So if I successfully give you the rule for how to get theta to theta twiddle, then the rule for how chi twiddle transforms is now given to you. It's just chi gets multiplied by matrix gamma, where it's that matrix. Yeah.
Are you assuming something about the generators
you can use or something? No. So the claim I'm making is that a general group element can be factorized as an H element on one side times an element of the coset G over H on the left-hand side. That's what I'm relying on. So any group elements have this. Right. That's true, but I'm not relying on this being a group. I'm just saying that this is a, so that statement is, if I have a matrices like this, I multiply them together, I'm gonna get things that look like this. And they're not all gonna look like this after I multiply them together. That's the group statement. But the statement is that I take any matrix like this, I can decompose it in this way. That's actually important because that's good, tells you, that allows you to see how I'm gonna choose theta. Is that what I do? The rule for getting theta twiddle from theta will be, so I start off with a matrix. This U was defined to be just involving the x's, right? Because that was the Goldstone bosons only appeared there. I multiply it by G. Now I get some. This was in particular inside the group G. This is inside the group G. So this product is still inside the group G, but it's no longer going to be just something of this form. But it will have this form. It'll be something inside involving x's, but also something involving some of the t's.
What are the X's?
The X's are the broken generators. They're the ones for which,
yeah.
V, you know, they hit the vacuum, they don't give you zero, whereas the T's are the ones that give you zero. These are a group, because if I have two that do this, then all the commutators will do this too. But these guys aren't a group, because if I take an X with an X, I can get a T sometimes. I'm talking there, I should say this explicitly. The group multiplication law, G1, G2 is equal to G3, in these Lie groups becomes a statement for these generators, which says that TA with TB is some coefficient C, you know, DAB TD. So if I take the commutator of two T's, then I get a linear combination of the T's. That's, so if I tell you what these coefficients are, I've told you the group multiplication law. That's the thing that I'm using. And another thing I'm going to use, I may not use it, but I also may use it and not tell you, is for the groups that we're interested in, the compact groups, the trace of TA, TB, the T's are Hermitian matrices, right? Because in the end of the day, I'm looking at real orthogonal matrices, so they're unitary. So these are imaginary and unitary matrices. And so this combination, if I call it NAB, it's symmetric, it's real, and it's positive definite because these guys are Hermitian. And so that means that for the groups of interest, for the compact groups, I can always choose, these T's are not unique. I can take linear combinations of them and I'll get a new set of structure constants. So there's an equivalence class of structure constants that describe a particular group. So I'm free, I have a freedom to redefine, take linear combinations of the generators can make things life easy for myself. And a convenient choice that you make for the compact groups is that this is equal to delta AB. So to do that, I can do that as long as this is something which is positive definite, because then what happens is I just diagonalize it and I scale out the eigenvalues into the T's, and then I'll have a set of generators that satisfy this. So I'm going to assume that I've done that. I may assume I've done that along the way. So that's not possible for all groups, but it's possible for the compact groups.
So sorry, is that just you rescaling all your generators?
And also taking linear combinations.
Because
this says that, you know, if A and B are different, this is zero. So that's not automatic. I have to take linear combinations to make it true. And the importance of this is that this implies that these C's are completely anti-symmetric. So the definition says that the left-hand side is anti-symmetric under AB, so it was always anti-symmetric under A and B. But if I define C, A, B, C to be this thing, you know, delta, actually would have been N, but I take delta A, D, C, D, B, C. If this is true, then this is completely anti-symmetric under all permutation of everybody. So this is a completely anti-symmetric thing under any interchange of any of the labels, and I may use that at various places. And where that comes up is, this is again an aside, but it's, I might as well say it. You know, we know that the T's.
Question?
Yeah. No, the thetas are the Goldstone. The phis were the original fields. The thetas will be the Goldstone modes, and the chis will be the non-Goldstone modes.
But you wrote down phi tilde equal to g times phi, right? So I was assuming your phi is also perpendicular to your Goldstone modes.
Yeah, that's because the logic I'm taking is that I'm taking a specific example here where phi was some column vector, and I actually had a symmetry which is multiplying by some matrix. So in this example, I'm going to show you, I want to identify the Goldstone modes the way I did in this toy model by taking the vacuum and then doing a symmetry rotation away from the vacuum, and that'll give me the Goldstone modes. And then there'll be the rest, which are not the Goldstone modes, and those will be the chis. So this statement here is a statement that these are the Goldstone modes, and these are the ones that are not Goldstone modes. So these are like the rows.
So chi.
So chi, so this is.
Chi and phi tilde are perpendicular to both Goldstone modes.
Chi, phi, and phi tilde?
Yeah, are they perpendicular to Goldstone modes?
No, phi is everybody. So phi is the analog of the toy model where we had a complex field, phi 1 and phi 2.
Okay.
So phi is that, it's both rho and theta. Theta is the analog of theta, so it's the Goldstone mode. And chi is the analog of rho, which is the non-Goldstone mode, the guy who is massive.
I see.
Okay?
action transform to tilde, that's just you rotating.
That's the action under the symmetry, yeah. So I knew how the phi is transformed, and I'm going to try and, given that this is my rule for getting the thetas and the chis from phi, I want to know if I act on that rule with the symmetry, what's the rule for how the theta and chi transform how do they transform into the symmetry? Okay. And the claim is that they will separately they'll transform in ways that there's a rule I haven't got to yet that will tell you what the answer to that is. But before I do that, let me just finish the thought here. We knew that the H was a group. Remember the T's are the ones that kill the vacuum. So that's a group, subgroup. That defines the H. So we know that the generator is Kij. There's a subset of the algebra that the original group satisfied some algebra like this. And I was about to tell you about the why I was making a big deal about this choice here that I made, that choice, and that being antisymmetric. So we had this, and this is a special case of this where I restrict myself to the generators that are in H. But the important point here is that there's no X's here. So the important part of this statement is that C, if you like, I, J, X, or alpha, is equal to 0. If I take two T's, I only get T's. I don't never get any X's. In this rule, I could have, in principle, got anything, right? So this is a statement that H is a subgroup. H is a subgroup. But now, the reason this is important, this choice makes this completely antisymmetric, because that means that if this is 0, it's also true that I alpha j is 0. And that's the statement that if I take a t and I commute it with an x, I only get x's. Yeah, I only get x's because the j's are 0. Let me just finish. Let me just write it here. So C I alpha beta X beta. So I might use this because this says that it's a subgroup, and this says that the X's carry a representation. If I transform X by an H transformation, I get another X. So for example, if I had had a If I've been talking about 3x3 orthogonal matrices, and the subgroup had been 2x2 orthogonal matrices, then so if I have 3x3 orthogonal matrices, and the subgroup is this one here, the generators that are, since these are antisymmetric matrices, they're Hermitian and they're imaginary, so they're antisymmetric. So this would be basically 0. This guy. These would be the x's, and this is just minus that, and this is the t's in that case of the 2x2 matrices inside 3x3 matrices, and these x's have the property that they form a representation of if I act on them with these guys, I get these guys. These guys acting on these guys just give me a matrix acting on these guys again. So they carry a representation. They're a 2x2-dimensional representation of the subgroup is what this says, and I'm probably going to use that later on over there. So those facts are all coming from, the important thing was this, and that came from the fact that we're talking about compact groups. And the other good thing about compact groups is that there's a list of them, right? It's the orthogonal groups, it's the unitary groups, it's the symplectic groups, and the exceptional groups, and that's it. Yeah. No, it's a. You're asking, is that the same statement as the reputation thing? I don't think so. I think this is a more general statement.
Do you use this to prove something like that? Because in general, you have to do a Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff expansion type of thing, right?
Right.
I guess they just missed why all those other things that you normally include aren't there.
Well, the beautiful thing about these groups is that it's all you need to follow is the infinitesimal thing. So maybe what I'm about to say might make you happy, because the claim I'm going to make is that let me go back to the main line of development here, right? So I took phi and I decomposed it in terms of something inside the coset times chi. And I did the same thing for phi twiddle. And then I just used the transformation rule for phi that I knew. And then I that led me to this statement. So the statement was that chi twiddle transforms in this way, and that's so far just a definition. But the transformation rule for theta is going to hinge on the issue you're talking about. So the statement is that so the way I should read this is that I started off with a matrix U. I multiplied it by G, and I want to recompose it. I want to decompose it as a. I want to take this matrix and I want to write it as something in the coset times something in H. And I'm going to use theta, the freedom to choose theta, to do that. So if you kind of operationally think about how would I do that, what I would do is I'd write out this product the way or I'd write out this product using the Baker Campbell-Hausdorff thing. But I could just do it at the linearized level. I just write this as being one plus something, and I'm going to get. So let's say I do that. I have 1 plus I omega a ta, which I can write out as being omega alpha x alpha. Plus I omega I ti. And then u was 1 plus I theta alpha x alpha. And so I write that out. I'm going to get 1 plus I. I'll have omega alpha plus theta alpha x alpha plus I omega I ti. And I want to compare it to this. Right, and you can kind of see that what I'm going to do. So there's nonlinear things too. But if I at the linearized level ask what's going on, what I'm going to do is I'm going to define this to be theta twiddle, and this will be, you know, what I'm going to call omega. And so my rule for what theta twiddle is it's the choice of parameter I would have to have made to take this matrix and write it as something in the coset times something in the unbroken group. And it's not like so the claim that I'm making is that there exists a theta that can do that. That if I multiply those two matrices together, I can always write it as being something in H times something in the coset. So at this level, this says that theta twiddle is theta plus omega, which is kind of like the generalization of this, that I'm shifting things. That's the sign of a Goldstone boson. There's no way that a vacuum can be invariant if a field is shifting, because whatever that field was takes a different value in the new vacuum after you've done the symmetry. So it must have been true that the vacuum was not invariant. So that's the kind of the sign of a spontaneous symmetry breaking. But this rule that theta gets replaced by theta twiddle, according to the rule that I take that product, decompose it in this way, and I call the coefficient of the coset theta twiddle, that's this plus nonlinear corrections. And that's the transformation rule I'm looking for. So let me write that somewhere. So here's the rule.
Did you say theta tilde equals?
What's that?
You say theta tilde equals theta plus omega or alpha?
It's theta tilde will be theta plus omega, where omega is the parameter that defined G.
Okay.
Plus corrections, plus things involving theta squareds and stuff. So okay. I'll write it out in a second. But the statement of the rule is I take U of theta, which is e to the I. I multiply by G. So, and then what I do is I decompose the product into the form of something involving only the x's times something involving the living in H. And I'll call that gamma, where gamma, which I'll call e to the I ui ti, is an H. And u of theta twiddle is e to the I theta twiddle alpha x alpha for some theta twiddle alpha. And this rule is the definition of theta twiddle alpha. I choose the theta such that this I do this multiplication and I decompose it in this way, and what appears here is the theta twiddle. That's my rule for how theta transforms. And the gamma here will depend on theta, theta twiddle, and g. So notice that that gamma is a function of theta, theta twiddle, and g. Or equivalently, this u is a function, ui is ui of theta, theta twiddle, and g. And then the rule for chi is this. So this is just, if I compare this to that, you can see that chi, this gamma here is the same as this gamma here. So the rule for chi this is the rule for theta goes to theta twiddle, is that chi is equal to gamma times chi. So once you found this gamma, this decomposition not only told you the rule for theta twiddle, it also gave you a gamma. That gamma is the rule for how chi transforms. So these chi fields are transforming only under the unbroken group, H, because gamma lives in H. So that's the rule. This is the what I'm giving you here is the paper is Coleman. It's called CCWZ. So it's Coleman, Allen, West, Cimino, nonlinear realization. And the important thing is that there's no loss of generality in this representation, that if someone gives you a symmetry breaking pattern for Goldstein bosons, you can always do a field redefinition that makes the transformation look like this. Okay. So now how do we make a Lagrangian that's invariant under this? You'll see that there's a subtlety here. Or there's a complication, maybe not a subtlety. Actually, let me actually write out what the I told you I was going to tell you what that looked like if you expanded it out in powers of theta. I'll come back to that. Before I do the Lagrangian, let me just make more explicit that transformation rule. So the way in practice you'd use this is if your group is simple enough, then you can actually explicitly do this decomposition. Like if it's SU2 or something, which is the example I'll do, you can always write the Pauli matrices out in such a way that you can do that makes this explicit. But if you have some bizarre big group, often all you need to know is how these things behave in powers of theta. And what you do is literally write everything out, just write this expansion out and equate both sides and group the terms and then read off what theta twiddle had to be. And so I want to write down what the answer to that is so it's not hypothetical. So delta theta, that's theta twiddle alpha minus theta alpha, turns out to be omega alpha. That was the first term that we found over there. But then the next term is going to be C alpha beta gamma times omega beta theta gamma, and then there's a theta squared term. So this is kind of a linear transformation rule. This is actually called the adjoint representation. That's basically saying that if someone gives you the structure constants, if you're looking for representations of the generators of a group, the rule T alpha beta gamma, alpha T beta alpha gamma. If I define it to be I times C alpha beta gamma, so if I take the structure constants and I think of that as a matrix, this matrix will satisfy the algebra of the group for free. So if anyone gives you structure constants, they've for free handed you a representation, and that's called the adjoint representation. And so this is transforming in that representation, is what that says, essentially. And then delta chi, I think I wrote down two. No, I might not have written that down, sorry. I thought I had, but let's... Oh, here we are, yeah. So so gamma is e to the I ui times ti, where ui in the same approximation is minus c of, let me write it, end it down, I ui is c I alpha beta omega alpha theta beta plus order theta squared. So it's a completely well-defined, tedious rule to do this order by order in powers of theta.
So why are you spending
theta? Just because I want a way of making it explicit as a function, theta twiddle as a function of theta. And so if you give me a specific group.
The transformation parameter omega though.
Yeah. Yeah, so all these things involve omega. So here's the omega. What's going
to
happen is that the transformation rule will be linear in omega. So that so you're right. Yeah. So the thing is that this is going to be omega beta, if I like c alpha beta of theta. So there's a transformation rule I'm giving you, which is infinitesimal in omega, but it's a nonlinear function of theta. That's the unusual thing, is that it's not just linear in theta. And the same thing's true here. This would have been, I forgot to write it here. Or I guess u is the has the omega in it. You could write this as being omega alpha u alpha I of theta. So we want to make an action for this. And so you might think, well, that's easy. Because all you have to do is build it out of these U's, right? And these U's are matrices. But the tricky part is that this transformation rule, because it's everything depends on the thetas are fields, right? The symmetry we had was a global symmetry where the omegas were constants. But now the transformation rule for these things, they look simple. But if you think of the transformation rule for chi is transforming under an H transformation, but it's a very funny H transformation because it's a field-dependent H transformation, because it's got these thetas and theta twiddles everywhere in it, right? In this board here, you can see that U doesn't depend just on omega, it depends on theta. So that means that, and this depends on X. So although we were talking originally about a global symmetry where we just did a rigid rotation in G, The transformation rule for chi is a local transformation because it depends on the field, and the field depends on position. So that means that the rule for making a Lagrangian for this is going to be a little bit more complicated than the usual rule because we're effectively implementing a local symmetry rather than a global symmetry. And the same thing is true for theta. The transformation rule for theta, because it has theta squareds and stuff in it, this thing is a function of x. And so if we make... If we take the part of the Lagrangian that has no derivatives, that won't be a big deal because then it won't matter that things are a function of x, but the kinetic terms are going to be a bigger deal. We have to figure out a way to make the kinetic terms invariant, even though the transformation rules now have position dependence in them. So the thing that's complicated about making these Lagrangians is we're looking for a way to make things gauge invariant, essentially. And saying it that way tells you how you solve the problem. We're looking for to make this thing into a local symmetry, so we're looking for a gauge potential, if you like. We're looking for a way to make this thing. So since the transformations depend on theta of x. They are space-time dependent. So invariants of kinetic terms in d mu theta, d nu theta alpha. Be tricky. But we're looking for, if we're looking for a Lagrangian for the Goldstone bosons alone, we'd be looking for something which was, we want a potential as a function of the thetas, we'd want a kinetic term like 1/2 g alpha beta of theta times d mu theta alpha, d mu theta alpha, plus higher derivative terms. And what I'm trying to do now is identify what's the functions that are allowed here for v of theta and g alpha beta of theta that are consistent with the symmetry transformation rule that we just derived. And the answer for this will be simple. This has to be a constant because part of this transformation was theta shifts. The only way to make a potential invariant under shifts will be that it's got to be independent of theta. So the symmetry will imply that V is equal to constant, just like it did for the abelian case. That's the information that the Goldstone bosons are not coupling at low energies. So the statement that Goldstone bosons are interacting weakly at low energies is that. That's how the symmetry enforced it. And what we're going to ask here is that the this be invariant. Yeah?
You say g alpha beta and d mu theta alpha d mu theta, you mean beta, right?
Here? Yes, beta, thank you. I actually filled my pockets with pennies. They're not legal tender, but I can throw them around now. So I owe you a penny. Thank you. So there's two ways to proceed here, and so if anybody has had general relativity, this will start to look familiar because if you wanted to know, say, why this potential was a constant, and if you ask how does this Lagrangian behave under field redefinitions? So let's say I take delta theta alpha is equal to some function of theta. If I ask, what does this, if I do this transformation where I change theta, if I plug that into this Lagrangian, I take theta is equal to theta plus delta theta, and I ask, what's the change to the Lagrangian? It'll have the form of a change to this function of V, which is independent of derivatives. And then the two derivative terms can always be written like this with a new delta G. The rule for the delta G and the delta V is a rule that you'll recognize if you've taken general relativity. So under that transformation, what happens is that V goes to V twiddle, which is V plus delta V, where delta V is just F alpha partial V partial theta alpha. And the rule for G is that G alpha beta goes to G twiddle alpha beta, which is G alpha beta plus delta alpha G alpha beta. And delta G alpha beta is just F alpha or F gamma partial G alpha beta partial theta gamma plus partial F gamma partial theta alpha g gamma beta plus partial f gamma partial theta beta g alpha gamma. And if you walked into the room right now and you had not heard anything until now, you would have said, oh, this is general covariance. This is how a scalar field transforms under a quadrant transformation. And this is how a covariant rank two tensor transforms under a quadrant transformation, where the quadrant transformation was x or theta was the coordinate, goes to theta plus f. So this is a scalar, and this is a symmetric tensor. So what's going on here is that if I was a mathematician, everything would be a map, right? So if this is space-time, and this is, we have scalar fields, they take their values in some space. So call that the target space. So theta maps from space-time theta alpha of x. Theta is coordinates in this space, but it takes its values from this space. So the coordinates here would be x mu. Coordinates here would be theta alpha. This tells you that the story of the Lagrangian, the Lagrangian has a geometrical interpretation on the target space, that it's the scalar potential is a scalar under field redefinitions, the scalar behaves like a scalar field would have done on the target space. And this thing behaves like a symmetric tensor, but not only that, the kinetic energy had to be positive. So this had to be a symmetric matrix which was positive definite. So that's a metric. A symmetric covariant positive rank 2 positive matrix is a metric on your space. So this thing, if you find it, can be interpreted as being a metric on the target space. And what we're asking now is that if we want this Lagrangian to be invariant, we have a specific rule for what F is. We're saying that there's a specific set of Cs, which we just derived, and we want this metric to not change under that. And we want V not to change under that. And so if you're a differential geometer, you would recognize that this is the Lie derivative of V with respect to this vector. And we have a vector for every dimension of the space. So that means that we essentially have a space which is translation invariant, where the translations are these Xs, and that's why V has to be a constant. And what we're asking for the kinetic term is, what's the invariant metric under these symmetries? So these have to be killing vectors for this vector, for this metric. And so you can use the techniques of differential geometry to construct what this metric is. And those techniques are actually the techniques you get from what I'm doing here now. What I'm describing here is a homogeneous space. It's a coset space where you have a group divided by another group. And we're constructing the metric, the invariant metric for that group. But there's a very geometrical flavor with what we're doing. And let me just kind of cut to the chase and tell you what the answer is. Or maybe actually it's a bit of a chase. So why don't I pick that up next class there? But we're just about done. What the rule will be, let me just tell the punchline. The punchline is, I'm going to give you a way of constructing a gauge field living on that target space as a function of theta. And I'm going to give you a way of constructing a Feierbein or an n-bein living on the target space. And the rule for writing the Lagrangian will be the standard one. If I gave you a local symmetry, then you would say, well, there's a gauge field for that. And I just make covariant derivatives with a gauge field. This is the gauge field. I'll give you the rule for that. And I'm going to want to make it, and I'll build the Lagrangian out of these guys, their derivatives, and their covariant derivatives. So there'll be a rule for the covariant derivative of this will be the partial derivative plus something involving A, plus an A term. And I'll construct that next time. And the moral of the story is, if you have a bunch of fields, if you have a symmetry group, G breaks to H, and at low energies you've got a bunch of Goldstone bosons and maybe some other fields, the rule for making the Lagrangian is a simple one. You make an H-invariant Lagrangian, so you ignore G, just make it H-invariant, because that's the unbroken group for the ordinary matter. And then you can make it G-invariant for free by coupling it to the Goldstone bosons in the appropriate way. So the Lagrangian will be constrained only by H-invariants, but then by rules like this, where we couple fields to the Goldstone bosons in a specific way, we can promote that H-invariance into a G-invariance for free. And so the information of the group breaking from G to H is all in how the Goldstone bosons couple to the fields at low energies, and there's no extra information beyond that at low energies. That's where we're going to go. And all I have to do is tell you the rule for building these things, and then that along the way tells you how to make invariant metrics on these homogeneous spaces. So we'll pick that up next time.